Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is A.B. Dawji, and of course, this is The Big Picture. Now, let me tell you something. I come racing into the studio every Saturday. Racing into the studio. And today I raced even more, all breathless, just made it in time. And when I left home in my daughter's car. My car was parked in front of her, so I had to take her car. And it's a lovely car. It's a BMW 220i two-door. Oh! So I really needed that car. And she's got personalized plates. Faiza. F-A-E-E-Z-A. Faiza. Personalized plates. So I really enjoy driving the car here. For three reasons. Number one, it's automatic. My car is manual. And secondly, it's very fast. It reminds me of the time that I spent in that lousy Joburg, 5 years in Benoni. Oh, very fast. So I came here speeding. But you know what's the best part about me coming in her car? Because I told you it's got personalized plates. And every time I was all along the road, I had guys overtaking me to look at Faiza, and they saw this bald old bully there. Hey, lots of luchas on the road, eh? Lots of luchas. So yes, this is The Big Picture, your weekly dose of news analysis with added masala. And we begin as usual with a look at the bizarre, the crazy, the loony stories that made it into the news. As regular listeners would know, we also focus on so many people who can do some really, really silly things. And we have categorized such characters into different grades. Firstly, we have the Ullus. Now, psychologists have determined that the average Ullu is one who suffers from some measure of cognitive dissonance. Ish, lovely word that. Cognitive dissonance, which means that a person will somehow make an excuse to himself if confronted with a situation that goes against what he really believes. Sounds very complicated, eh? Cognitive dissonance. And many politicians, in fact, are like this. Consider this. I am in Zuma's government. I see lots of corruption. I'm an honest guy. So I tell myself, hey, if I leave the cabinet or being an MP, then things would be worse. Let me stay and I can try somehow to stop it from the inside. So I won't resign because from outside I can do nothing. Meanwhile, the real reason I'm staying is that I like the falus, the fat salary that I'm getting. Well, there you are. A wonderfully flawed definition of cognitive dissonance. Or ulluness. We now move to the next category. This is the typical laddu, who we also describe sometimes as an alu. He is the guy who just blunders along, not realizing that the world sees him as a little unbalanced. As in the old days, we would say, hey, that fellow's screw is a little bit loose, eh? Or maybe we say, his lift doesn't go all the way to the top floor. And then we get the final category, the highest one, the mampara. This is a combination of the ullu and the laddu. Sometimes such individuals are very difficult to recognize, to distinguish, to make the difference out. On occasion, they seem to be quite lucid. Nice word. I learned some big words this morning from the dictionary just to use on you, to impress you. So they appear quite normal and act intelligent. And at other times, they take stupidity to a new level. That is the behavior of a typical mampara. And the best way to define a mampara is in just two words. Donald Trump. Well, there you are, dear listeners, your weekly psychology lesson. Who said that The Big Picture wasn't an educational program? Okay, so let's look at some of the characters who this week displayed such behavior. Here's the first story, but let me say this first. I am sure that all of you who drive cars have at some time in your life been pulled up by a cop for speeding or shooting a robot or something like that. it must have happened to you at some stage, at some time, or maybe perhaps a few times. Usually when you get your license, you are very, very careful. Very careful. You drive slowly until you are confident enough to drive faster. So listen to this story from the CNN. Nothing lasts forever. And a German teenager has learned that lesson the hard way by losing his driving license just 49 minutes after passing his test. The 18-year-old, who was apparently celebrating his achievement by driving four of his friends around, was clocked traveling at almost twice the speed less than an hour after his test. This is what police said. He had his short-lived license revoked for 4 weeks and will have to have more training sessions behind the wheel. The teenager was also hit with a 200 euro fine. That's $228 multiplied by 14 to get rands after being caught traveling at 95 kilometers an hour in a 50 kilometer zone in the Markischer Kreis region of Germany. German police said in a statement on their Facebook page, "Some things hold for eternity, some not even an hour." Ish, these German cops are all philosophers, eh? And they also speculated that the driver was trying to impress his fellow passengers. Well, that goes without saying. And still on the issue of crime, I am sure that you heard the term money laundering. Money laundering? You've heard the term, right. Briefly, it means taking dirty money, that is money that you acquire through crime, and getting it cleared or passing it through legitimate business. Well, here's a story also from CNN which takes the definition of money laundering literally. The term money laundering was never more appropriate than this week when Dutch police searching a house found around $400,000 stuffed inside the drum of a washing machine. A man present in the house during Monday's raid was arrested on suspicion of, yes, you've guessed it, money laundering. When the police did a search through the house, they found 350,000 euros. Well, actually, this is reported in the British newspaper. It was inside the washing machine. $400,000. There you are. And now to the next story. But before that, let me briefly look at the news that was in all the newspapers this week. The reluctance of the insurance company that refused to pay out the widow of a man who was shot dead. Why? Because he did not because he did not declare that he had diabetes when he took out the policy. Well, the comedian Barry Hilton posted this. He says, "I've just taken out an insurance policy against my insurance policy, refusing to pay out a claim. It's gaining momentum." yeah. Well, that was Barry Hilton. Anyway, that story about the widow had a happy ending. As you all know, the insurance company agreed to pay out. And then you have many people who will sue a big company for the most ridiculous reasons. In 1994, a 79-year-old lady by the name of Stella Liesbeck successfully sued McDonald's for burns that she suffered. She said that the coffee that she was served was too hot. She accidentally spilt it onto her lap and got burnt. The court in the United States awarded her, are you ready for this? Awarded her $2.86 million. Again, multiply that by 14 and you'll get the rands. On appeal, this was reduced to $640,000, and that's close to 9 million rands. Wow! Anyone joining me to McDonald's for coffee today? Come, let's go. We could come out millionaires, eh? Well, just in case you are interested, such cases are known as frivolous litigation. Again, a big word that I learned today. Frivolous litigation, meaning wasting the court's time. Well, I don't see anything frivolous in 9 million rands, ne? As you know, I fly a lot. In 3 weeks' time, I'm off to the Middle East again. Hey, are you on one of my tours? December is Vietnam and Spain and Morocco and India and with Kashmir and Cairo. And of course, we have the Middle East tour. I will be going on that one. But it's too late. We are almost all completely full. So all you Joburgers, you just have to come and chill in Durban, okay? And that's why I'm running away from here. Shoo, you people choke up everything. Have to stand in queues at restaurants like it's Black Friday. I always dread it when I'm flying. For example, if a fat O, big size guy, plonks himself next to me, oof, the seats are so narrow. On my last flight, one chap's arm, which was the size of a leg of lamb, it filled the whole armrest and spilled onto my side. That was really bad. And he snored all the way on the 8-hour flight. It was a nightmare. Well, just like that, that auntie who got 9 million rands for the spilt coffee, I'm going to do what this fellow in the next story did. Listen to this. A holidaymaker who is suing British Airways for £10,000 has told a court he was injured after being forced to squeeze into a seat next to an obese man who was, in his words, the size of Jonah Lomu. Jonah Lomu, of course, is an All Blacks, he's passed away, rugby player. Stephen Prosser, 51 years old, claims he suffered personal injury and loss of earnings after being made to sit next to the large passenger during a 12-hour flight from Bangkok to Heathrow. On Friday, the court heard the self-employed civil engineer claim that cabin crew ignored his complaints that he would be injured if forced to sit next to this extremely large passenger, who he described as being 6'4" and weighed approximately 140 kilograms. Prosser, who is 5'3", said, he was that large that he had to force his buttocks between the armrests of the seats. He sat with his knees wedged against the seat in front, and the rest of his body was overlapping, if it was overspilling into my seat by some inches. I was immediately aware that this was going to be problematic for me, and I could feel the weight of this, of his pure bulk, putting lateral pressure on my upper body. This forced me into a position of unnatural posture. Due to the size of him, when he placed his arm down, at times it would rest on my armrest, and he would accidentally turn the volume of my audio up to an extremely loud volume each time. Imagine that, eh? His arm was so fat that it was on his volume control, and suddenly the sound went right up. He said he chose not to take issue with the passenger because he seemed self-conscious, but did complain to the cabin crew, who allegedly told him there were no other seats available on the fully booked 777, and did not allow him to swap with someone else. Prosser from Wales said the incident in January 2016 left him with a continual back spasm and an injury causing his sacroiliac joint at the bottom of his spine to malfunction. He said being forced into an unnatural position during the long-haul flight also aggravated a 12-year-old spine injury caused by driving long distances for work. He said he had been unable to work overtime as a result of his back pain, and he was left lacking energy, which had affected his relationship with his partner and forced him to give up mountain biking. And of course, the hearing continues. Now, there you are. I hope that on my next flight, a big fat guy comes and sits next to me. I'm going to be very rich. I'm going to sue them. Right? And the final story. Now, listen here, ladies. Sometimes you all can be really, really cruel, eh? Ladies, please promise me that you won't repeat this story when the bully is sitting down having lunch with his mouth full of minced biryani. Here's the reason why. And this was reported in the Khalij Times. Khalij Times. The Moroccan woman has been charged with murder after she confessed to killing her boyfriend and chopping him up. And this was in the United Arab Emirates. The Moroccan national had been in a relationship with the victim for 7 years, but killed him after he announced his intention to marry someone else. After being questioned about the man's disappearance by police, the woman, who is in her 30s, confessed to the murder, calling it a moment of insanity, stating that she had wanted revenge after financially providing for her lover for several years. Although the murder reportedly took place some 3 months ago, the crime was only discovered last week after a human tooth was found in her blender, her mixer, by the victim's brother. The man went on to report his brother missing to Al Ain police, who carried out DNA tests on the tooth and confirmed it belonged to the victim. So, dear listeners, why was the tooth found in the liquidizer, in the mixer? And here's the reason. Hold your breath, okay? While police did not reveal how the victim was killed, they did reveal that his girlfriend had subsequently minced and cooked her partner and served up his remains as part of a traditional rice and meat dish to some Pakistani nationals working nearby. The leftovers were fed to neighborhood dogs. Ladies, I warned you, okay? Okay. And of course, the chopping of a body is in the news every day. New revelations every day about Khashoggi. New shocking revelations. One Khashoggi after another. The noose is slowly tightening around Mohammed bin Salman's neck, MBS as he's called. Latest is that the murder was planned 12 days in advance. And even more shocking, one of the voices speaking on the phone to a mastermind of the murder is said to possibly be that of MBS. That was reported on Al Jazeera today. So, in spite of all these revelations and the conclusion of the CIA that pointed to MBS as the man behind Khashoggi's murder, one man refuses to concede this, Donald Trump. He still says, well, we really don't know who planned it. Mohammed bin Salman says he didn't, and I believe him. Listen, dear Ulu, a killer won't say that he did it. And why is Donald J. Trump, Donald Jungly Trump, so stubborn about this? Well, he says Saudi is a great ally. It keeps the oil prices down. We thank them for it. This is what he tweeted 2 days ago. And he said Saudi Arabia keeps Iran in check. Well, many have said that he has business interests with the Saudis, especially his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. But let me address the elephant in the room about the real story why Donald Trump is so steadfast in not conceding. And we'll do that after this break. Welcome back. The program is called The Big Picture. Now, before the break, I was asking the question, why has Donald Trump not condemned Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, in spite of the conclusion of the CIA? And I said that Donald Trump says that MBS has been keeping the oil price down, and also we have to support him because he is keeping Iran in check and so on. But let me address the main issue as to why he hasn't condemned. Let me address the elephant in the room. Now, my view is that Donald Trump is serving the interests of Israel. What Israel wants is what Israel gets. Israel has been saying for years that it wants the whole world, including the U.S., to move their embassies to Jerusalem and thereby recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. The whole world refused. Donald Trump moved it. Move the embassy to Jerusalem. So, why is he so beholden to Israel? Well, for one thing, Mike Pence, the U.S. Vice President, is a Christian evangelical, the group who believe that the Bible supports the creation of the state of Israel. Sam's chief advisor is, as I told you before, John Bolton, who he pushed George Bush to declare war on Iraq, which was described as the war for Israel. He always boasts that he was single-handedly responsible for getting the United Nations to cancel the resolution which said that Zionism is racism. But the big one, the mega donor to Trump, to Trump's 2016 election campaign, is Sheldon Adelson. He is an owner of many casinos, and he's a multi-billionaire, and he donated $82 million to Donald Trump's campaign in 2016. And it's reported that he had thrown $150 million into a futile effort to unseat Obama in the 2012 elections. And he described Obama as a socialist and anti-Israel. $150 million were thrown in that exercise to get rid of Obama. So, there you are, a heavyweight backer of Israel and also of Donald Trump. He was getting impatient with Trump for not moving the embassy fast enough, and so Donald Trump did what he was told. As former Congressman Pat Buchanan said, the U.S. Congress is Israeli-occupied territory, and now the White House is also captured by Israel. I told you all this before. So, Benjamin Netanyahu said very strongly he does not want MBS to go, and therefore Trump does not want MBS to go. See how clear it is? From the time Israel was created, it had to sort out a few things. Make sure that the militant movements were destroyed, that's Hezbollah and Hamas. It had to neutralize its hostile Arab neighbors. And how to achieve that? Well, keep the dictators in power. Why? Because the dictators can be removed if a dictator can be removed if he is a threat to Israel, and America will do the job. Saddam Hussein was too big for his boots, and so Iraq was destroyed. So Saudis and the rest have to be kept in power. And of course, as we know, Egypt and Jordan have peace deals with Israel. So in recent years, Israel has been pursuing friendly relations with the Arab countries. It's out in the open, in fact. Step by step, Netanyahu was well received in Oman recently. He speaks openly about this. Listen to this. A report in June of this year, straight out of the horse's mouth. Israel is pursuing a policy of subterranean normalization with Arab countries that will eventually bring a peace deal with the Palestinians. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Thursday in an interview with BBC television. Speaking on Newsnight program during a visit to London, Netanyahu said he believed that cooperating more closely with Arab states was a path to peace and suggested that relations with the Arab world would have never been better. Netanyahu said, "I would never believe that in my lifetime we would have the kind of friendly relations and cooperation between Israel and the Arab states. And here is the most promising thing," he said, that is beginning to affect public opinion in some of the Arab countries. They are beginning to think of Israel differently, and this is what Israel longed for. I am deliberately pursuing this policy of cooperation with the Arab world, not only because it is good on its own merits, but also because I believe it is a path to peace." So this report says that deepening relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia, which have included Riyadh's support for U.S. President Donald Trump's so-called deal of the century for Palestine. And the U.S. and its Arab allies plan to push through the deal even without Palestinian support. Details of the proposed plan have yet to be officially revealed, but it is reported to press the Palestinians to give up East Jerusalem as the capital and cancel their right of return to the lands taken by Israel in 1948 and 1967. Last November, it was reported that the Jordanian monarchy was concerned that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was rushing to normalize relations with Israel at the expense of both the Jordanians and Palestinians. Netanyahu said, we are having this subterranean normalized, secret normalization, and I think that as we normalize relations with Arab nations, not necessarily to fully fledged peace treaties that we have with Egypt and Jordan, but it will take time to get with the others, that it will eventually also impact the 1% of the Arab world who are Palestinians. And this is what he said. I say normalize relations with the 99% and you'll eventually get peace with the 1%, although I think we should do it in tandem. Did you hear that? You see how clear it is? If the Arab world makes peace with Israel, then the Palestinians have no choice but to accept any kind of peace deal put on the table, which in actual fact means that the Palestinians don't really matter. They are not relevant, and so Israel can decide to do whatever it wants. The Palestinians will eventually have no friends. Israel will have all the friends to push through its plans with no opposition whatsoever. So now you see why Netanyahu does not want MBS to go, and that is why Trump says he does not believe MBS did it, in spite of the mounting evidence, even if it makes him look increasingly foolish, a first-class mampara. That, dear listeners, is the actual big picture. You get it? And let's see what else MBS has been doing. Let us see what MBS has been doing, and we have little time, so we're going to rush through in the next 15 minutes and speak to Professor Suleiman Dengo. Suleiman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
So, tell us, Suleiman, what else has been happening besides this murder of Khashoggi?
Okay, you know, there was an interview with Sheikh Salman Auda's son the other day. And one of the things he mentioned is that this is not the first instance. Now the world knows about Khashoggi. I mean, he's killing, but he said it's not the first instant. This has been going on for a while. And so maybe I'll just mention a few instances. Some of them are known, you know, globally, but others are not known at all. One was these are abductions by the Saudis, by the way. One was by Saud bin Saif al-Nasser. Was very critical of the Saudi regime, and you know, there's a movement in Saudi Arabia called the Sahwa movement. It's very close to the Ikhwan al-Muslimin. In fact, they've been influenced by the Ikhwan, and in the beginning they maintain quite a close relationship with the Saudi regime, and that's why the Saudis were not really concerned about Ikhwan. They were Ikhwan members like Muhammad Qutb, the brother of Sayyid Qutb, who were living there, even teaching there, because they didn't see the Ikhwan as a threat. But it all changed, of course, after the Egyptian revolution, after the Arab Spring, when Ikhwan won elections and Morsi became president. And then they got really concerned because the Ikhwan were in Saudi Arabia, and then we see the crackdown on Ikhwan began. And this also means that the Sahwa movement then came under the spotlight, because this movement is very closely aligned, or rather very closely aligned to the Ikhwan Muslim. So some of the people who have been arrested were members of this Sahwa movement, and I'll mention them just now. So Saud bin Saif was one of them, and he actually demanded that all those Saudis, of course it was an MBS at the time, all those Saudi royals who supported the coup in Egypt, where they got rid of Morsi and put Sisi in power, that they should be prosecuted. Now, I mean, this is very serious, asking for the prosecution of Saudi royals. So of course he got very and then of course in 2015 there were some letters from the Sahwa group to overthrow King Salman. So of course this is basically you know, seen as treason. So he was tricked into boarding a flight to Saudi Arabia. He was based in Italy at the time. And so he took this flight. When he got to Saudi Arabia, he disappeared. Nobody knows where he is, what happened to him. The second case is that of Prince Turki bin Bandar al-Saud. And remember, these are all princes, eh? We are talking about princes. And he moved to Paris. He was staying in Paris. And there he began to post videos online asking that there should be reformation in Saudi Arabia. Now, when we're talking about reformation, you know, we're not talking about what MBS is doing, you know, opening nightclubs and cinemas and opera houses, not that. When they're talking about reformation, they're talking about reformation of the political system, which of course will also then include the economic system. That's what they're talking about. And what happened to him, the, you know, he was in Paris. Somehow, I think he ended up in Morocco, and then he was detained there, and he was then deported to Riyadh. And since 2015, no one knows what has happened to him. The third case is Prince Sultan bin Turki. He was in Switzerland, and he was actually kidnapped from Switzerland. He was drugged. He was bundled onto a plane. And of course, a few years later, when he was released, he left Saudi Arabia. And then he boarded a Saudi plane in 2016. And this plane was supposed to go to fly to Cairo, to Egypt. That plane was rerouted to Riyadh. Imagine, they actually rerouted. They could have waited for him at Cairo airport. And the rest of the team, they rerouted him to the plane to Riyadh. And then, of course, he was forced off the plane. And nobody knows where he is. So these are princes, right? So you can understand that Khashoggi, you know, falls basically into that category. Of course, in this case, there are suggestions that they wanted to kidnap him. We don't know how far that is true. So this is just three examples of princes, members of the royal family, who was actually kidnapped and taken back to Riyadh, and nobody knows whether they are still alive or they are still in jail. Okay, then we come to the arrest. Now, we of course know about the arrest of all these businessmen and politicians and even members of the royal family. And they were put in a Ritz Hotel, the business people, and they were forced to hand over billions of dollars and so on. So he called this an anti-corruption crackdown. Right, so that happened, we know that. But at the same time, many of the shuyukh were arrested, many of the ulama. One of, and I mentioned a few of them. One was Safar al-Hawali, who was a leader of the Sahwa movement that I've been talking about. He published a book in which he criticized the Saudi rulers. And of course, he was demanding democracy. He basically asking for Shura. And also, he criticized the presence of American troops on Saudi soil. You know, many people in Saudi Arabia, they don't want the American troops there. And he was one of them. And also, he criticized the Saudi relationship with the United States. You know, it was a relationship of dependency. And of course, then eventually this blockade of Qatar. So he's of course one of the people who was arrested, is detained. Then we have Sheikh Khalid bin Ali al-Ghamadi, who was Imam of the Haram in Makkah. He has now been prevented from leading the Salah or from delivering lectures. Because what happens in Saudi Arabia, either if you're a Sheikh, you either praise the king or you praise MBS. And if you don't praise them, and if you are quiet, so, of course, if you criticize them, you're in trouble, you get into jail. But if you refuse to praise them, then you are dismissed from your job. And this is what happened with Al-Ghamadi. Then, of course, one of them, Suleiman Ad-Tawish, who was also jailed, he died in jail. Nobody knows how he died, whether he just died a natural death or he was actually killed. Of course, most people believe that he was actually murdered in jail. Then I think probably the most famous of them is Sheikh Salman Al-Awda. He's known internationally. And of course, he's been jailed many times, not just once. He's now in jail right now. As I said to you earlier, his son was interviewed on Al Jazeera. And he actually spoke about how people have been disappearing for a long while. And once they arrest these people, they don't allow family visitations. And if there is a trial, nobody's allowed to attend the trial. There's no due process. And of course, they get just thrown into jail and that's the end of it. Of course, some of them, of course, are even executed. So he was been jailed since September 2017, and he was jailed when he said that Qatar and Saudi Arabia, he hopes that they can reconcile. It was at that point that he was jailed. As I said, it was not the first time. He's also a member of the movement which I mentioned earlier, the Sahwa movement. He was actually jailed from 1994 to 1995. And only later on, the Saudis didn't crack down the Sahwa movement for a while until 2011 when they began to, they actually signed several petitions. And as many as 56 shuyukh condemned the coup in Egypt. And I said that's when they cracked down on the Sahwa and the Ikhwan al-Muslimun started in Saudi Arabia. Now, there are of course others who were arrested with Salman Awda. One is Sheikh Awad al-Karni, and the other one is Sheikh Ali al-Umari. And of course, we don't know when they will be released, if they will ever be released. So this is the position in Saudi Arabia. Then, of course, we come to the arrest of women. A number of women have been arrested. They were also demanding reforms. One, of course, was the permission to drive. They're not allowed to drive, in Saudi Arabia. And, it makes it difficult. I mean, they also demanded that the woman cannot move anywhere without a mahram. Now, we can understand if a woman is leaving the country and going, but if you are living in town, for instance, Durban, the husband is working or the father is working, the kids have to go to school, they have to go to madrasa. And we know that many of the women who are driving, they take the children to school, they take the children to madrasa, and without a mahram. Now, if you demand that they have to mahram, what's going to happen? Who's going to take the kids to school? Who's going to take them to madrasa and so on? So they were basically asking them that kind of, allowance or even to go for shopping and so on. And interesting thing is that one of the women who was demanding this actually has been arrested. So a number of them have been arrested since May. But not only have they been arrested now, Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have interviewed some women who were released, and they found that these women actually get tortured. Methods of torture: electrocution. Some of them are flogged, they are beaten on the face, on the hands, the feet, on the legs and so on. Some of them are deprived of sleep. That's a real torture when you're not allowed to sleep at all. There are bright lights, there's noise and so on. And some of them were in solitary confinement. So solitary detention. So these are some of the methods they use against the women. Why? Because they were making certain demands. And these women, some of them, when they were released, they found that they found difficulty in walking. So can you imagine what actually happened to them while they were in prison? Their hands were shaking, they had marks and scratches on their faces and their necks and so on. So it's very clear that these women have not just been imprisoned, but they've also been tortured, punished while they were in jail. The women, of course, are still in jail. They have not been released. So I think these are some of the things that have been happening in Saudi Arabia, unfortunately. And I don't think the situation is going to change very soon.
Well, there you are, a report from Professor Suleiman Dengo about life under MBS. Life under MBS. But we're going to finish off now and go straight to light at the end of the tunnel. Now, you know, here's what different types of people will say when visiting a very sick person in hospital. The American will say, "Get well soon, buddy." And the British will say, "Wishing you a speedy recovery, old boy." "Wishing you a speedy recovery, old boy." The Australian will say, "All the best, mate. All the best." Here is what the Indian will say. "Hey, you know what? I knew someone who died from the same disease, eh?" This is Amy Dawji bidding you all. Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.